I suppose of all the talks I give when John and I are invited to do something together, the one I look forward to least is the one on simple life. And John usually says, you can do that one, you know. I think it's because I don't want to prescribe what for our family or for us has been helpful. That doesn't necessarily mean it will be helpful for you. On the other hand, I think sometimes we make such broad, sweeping generalities that it really isn't helpful either, and so I'm always caught in the bind of, should I just make a list of things that would help to simplify your life, or do we just lay out some broad suppositions and let you fill in the spaces for yourself? I guess I'm going to do a little bit of both today, and I really hope that you'll talk about it when I'm done, or feel free to interrupt. I guess I should call this a shared word, because it is sharing with you what John and I and our kids have been struggling with for about 3 or 4 years now. I don't want you to think in any way that we've come up with answers or that we live a simplified life, because we don't. We're still struggling with it. I think sometimes some things we found that we have changed in our life, they've been very helpful. Some things I know I cannot do that I know I should do. So please, I just want to share our thinking with you, basically, and not a lot of answers that we've come up with. One of the things that I found helpful, and I would like to start with this, is a series of reasons that Jorgen Lissner from Lutheran World Federation gives. And he says that in the face of the global realities today, he thinks that comfortable Christians should change their lifestyles for the following reasons. And he gives about 10 or 12 of them, but I'm going to give you the five that I found most helpful. First, one reason to change our lifestyle is as an act of faith, that somehow or other there will be a more even distribution of the world's goods. And secondly, as an act of solidarity and sharing with those who have less than we have. That's really not possible for us to do. I know moving into the city and thinking, oh, we're going to live among the slums of Washington or something. We could never really have done that because there was so much in our educational background, in our culture. We never would be deprived in the way that some of those people were. But we could live a simpler lifestyle as an act of solidarity and sharing. Thirdly, he says it is an act of celebration, to celebrate the riches found in creativity and spirituality rather than in material kinds of possessions. And fourth, as a witness to others, because if you live a different way, people are going to start to say, you know, why are you acting like this? Why are you living in this way? And it gives a good chance to dialogue with others about justice issues. And the fifth thing is to redirect purchasing power away from artificially created needs to goods and services that really do benefit mankind. And today we're going to talk about that as a cheerful revolution. So much for Jorgen Lissner. I don't know whether those are helpful or not, but I kind of go back to them every once in a while when I'm wondering, you know, why am I really doing this? For me, simple life is something like the word shalom that John talked about the other day. I think you have to kind of walk around in the phrase for a little bit. Simple life encompasses a great many aspects, but basically to me it deals with the whole idea of global injustice. It's a social concept for me. It's like shalom stones in the Old Testament that were smooth and without jagged edges and round and perfect. To me, shalom, or a simplified lifestyle, would be like shalom stones, where some of the jagged edges are taken away and you have kind of a smooth wholeness about your life that you wouldn't have if you lived with a lot of complexity, as a lot of us do. Again, it's hard to describe simple life, but let me give you some words or phrases so that we'll know what we're talking about together. At least you'll understand my idea of a simplified lifestyle. I think it's abundant life. Jesus said, I came to give you life and come to bring it abundantly. I think it takes the blinders off of us when we see only kind of a success-oriented life or a material orientation. It takes these blinders off, and knowing that Jesus said, you know, your life doesn't consist of the number of things that you possess. It's something much more than this. And simple life to me is having control over your circumstances and not being controlled by events and other people. And I like Gandhi's quote there, you know, there is more to life than increasing its speed. Maybe it's just a pastor's wife and a mother of teenage kids, but sometimes you think your life is just going in 10, 12 different directions, and why all of a sudden don't I have control of my own circumstances? I think maybe students find that out a lot too. Thirdly, simple life seems to me to be having time with other people and not always so concerned about my own desires. I'm not talking about my own needs, because those have to be looked after too, but my own desires sometimes take much more time than I should give them. And to be able to spend more time with other people, I think, is very, very important. St. Francis believed that the secret of happiness was not only doing with less, but sharing what he had with other people, and going one step further and saying, in fact, I think it's even the secret of happiness is finding other people who have things that they could share with you. This was St. Francis's whole outlook, and I think that's very hard for us to understand. We had some friends that moved to Texas. He left the parish ministry and he started a bookstore, and they were very hard up for funds. And not that we had a lot, but we decided, let's share something of what we have. So we sent them a couple of $100s. And they wrote back very quickly and said, thank you, but we really cannot accept this $200. You know, we'll make it on our own. We know you love us and want to support us, but please take your money back. And I was really kind of hurt, because I thought, you know, here we have tried to share with them. It wasn't a big sacrifice for us at all. Even if it was, we loved them enough that we wanted to share, and I was really kind of angry with this attitude. Then when John left his job in Washington, D.C., and we moved out to a West Virginia farm without any salary or knowing what we were going to do, friends of ours gave us $1,000 and said, we want you to use this money in whatever way you can. That money sat in our bank account for a year. I mean, we couldn't even think of touching that $1,000 that they gave us. And at the end of the year, we gave it back and said, you know, I'm sorry, we just can't use this. I don't know what there is about us that makes us unwilling to put ourselves in a place of need, or to have others share with us. So I think simple life says something about a lot of sharing, not only with what we have, but being willing to take from others. And fourthly, another word to describe simple life for me is a certain freedom. If your wants are very simple, then you're going to have a lot of freedom, because those wants are going to be supplied. Jesus promised that, you know, I'm going to supply all your needs. And as Gandhi said, and I think we wrote in the book, he didn't say, I'm going to supply all your greeds. And when you get that separated, what are my needs and what are my greeds, then you're going to start to sense a certain type of freedom that I think Jesus wanted us to have. Thoreau said it beautifully, you know, a man is as rich as his ability to do without things, and I think that's very true. Simple life is a mindset. We've been talking about a new way of seeing, and I think of all aspects of things that make for peace, you have to begin to see differently. But somehow we have some kind of an eye disease, and I think we're blind to real wealth when we become so fixed on these lesser external kinds of material possessions. William Wadsworth wrote, getting and spending we lay waste our powers, little we see in nature that is ours. And I think John quoted Ernest Becker yesterday when he said, modern man is drinking and drugging himself out of awareness, or he spends his time shopping, which is the same thing. To me, it's an illness. And I know in myself, when I don't know what to do with myself, I think, well, let's go shopping. You know, maybe I don't even buy anything, but there's something about going into the marketplace with my marketplace mind and just looking at all of these things that is kind of a sickness within my soul. At least I feel it when I start to go on a shopping binge. Our compulsion for buying and having more and bigger things is, according to theologian Richard Baer, an effort to fight death. I had never thought of it this way, but he says, Such growth is no longer a rational procedure at all, but rather the result of a deep-seated psychological need to create the illusion that we are more than limited, finite beings. And then he goes on to add that until we recognize that man's spirit itself is the ultimate front line of the environmental crisis, or I would add any other kind of crisis, the energy crisis, the materialistic crisis that we find ourselves in, or whatever kind of crisis, we're just going to kind of continue to nibble around at the edges and never really get to the heart of the problem. And I don't think my spirit is going to be changed, or I'm going to have this metanoia until I have a different way of seeing. Because until the struggle is my struggle, I'm not going to accept anybody else's solution or answer. That's an important lesson that I've been learning. If I don't see consumerism as bondage, then I'm not going to see freedom in living with less. It'll simply be a deprivation to me, unless I can start to see that my instincts to buy and possess and consume really are a bondage, then there's nothing freeing in that. If my needs are insatiable, if I am convinced because of television and radio and magazine ads that my needs are absolutely insatiable, then I don't think I'm ever going to be satisfied, because there's always something better. There's always a better car, a more efficient appliance that's going to make my life a lot better, a faster acting headache powder, or a safer deodorant, or whatever it is. There's always something just a little bit better than what I have, and I don't see anything freeing in this attitude. I also need to see, if I'm going to see things biblically or differently, that my marketplace mind is not only a problem for me, but it's a problem for others. And I know it's not a lot of good to throw statistics around, but until we realize that we're 6% of the world's population and we consume 40% of the world's goods and a third of the food, it doesn't start to make much sense to live differently. If all of the people in the world were put in a village of 1,000 people, 837 of them would be living in some form of oppression or deprivation or hunger or some kind of persecution or sickness. 837 of my global brothers and sisters would be living in this kind of reality. And I'm not sure that the circumstances of one's birth should determine whether I live to be 5 or 85. You know, did God, the fact that I was born in a temperate zone where fertile ground is in the United States, does that mean I should eat and the rest of my global family starves? Until I can see my global brothers and sisters as part of my family, that just doesn't make any sense to me. Or who really owns the oil in the earth? You know, should it belong to the wealthy nations that can afford to go in and take it out and refine it? Is that who owns the resources? Until I see with a different kind of mind that God made these things out of his love for all his creation, and that I sin grossly when I take more than my share, then I don't think I'll see any need to simplify my life. So why did Dr. Karl Mao, who's executive director of Lutheran World Federation, come out with a statement a couple of years ago, and I think I started that chapter, A Simple Life, with his quote. He says, he asks that Christians in the Western world embrace a voluntary austerity and erect powerful signs of a new simplicity and lifestyle. I really thought that was a powerful statement and a very radical thing for the director of Lutheran World Federation to make, and nobody seems to be picking up on it or thinking it's very startling at all. But I think that the reason he says this about changing our lifestyles is that because our lifestyles are direct expressions of our personal values and our priorities. I had an Illich quote that I liked. We can only live changes. We cannot think our way into a new humanity. Every one of us, every group with which we work, must become the model of a new era that we desire to create. The many models which we'll develop should give each of us an environment in which we can celebrate our potential and discover the way into a more humane world. We can only live changes. We can't think our way into a new humanity. And I think for a lifestyle change, we need some kind of a symbol or stance. And just as in the 60s the symbol was the sit-in, maybe in the 70s, given the global realities that we have, the symbol or stance will be stepping out to become a happy disaffiliate, as Taylor says in his book Enough is Enough. That means that you're going to go against the grain of most of American society. But I think, again, until we start to see with a different kind of eye that this is what our Lord calls us to, we're not going to make much change in our lifestyle. If the world only has a limited bank account, then we're going to have to start saying, look, I, for one, am not going to take more than my share. The UN came up with a figure. In order for there to be a more economic distribution of goods, the United States and all the first world countries has to cut down their consumption of natural resources by one-third. Now, I don't know how you go about doing that unless each of us start to figure out in our own life, as maybe a guideline, how much do I have to cut down on my lifestyle, in my consumption of things, before I could see a more just economic of the world's resources. Now, I don't mean to say that things are bad in themselves. I think, and we mentioned it yesterday a little bit, I think, Tom, you asked the question. Bernard Eller, in one of the quotes in that chapter, says, Christian simplicity is not scrupulosity about possessions, but a joyous freedom regarding them. When God talked about his providence for men, or when Jesus did, he said, God's providence is that everybody have enough, good measure, shaken down, pressed together. You get this big bushel basket of grain that's just shaken down, and as much as put into it as possibly it can hold. And the psalmist said, my cup runneth over. He realized that God gives us abundantly, and this is what God wants for us. The concept, when I say to you, is it shalom with you today? When one Hebrew said that to another, he meant, look, have you got enough cash? Material well-being is very much a part of shalom lifestyle. It should be a very much a part of simplicity of lifestyle. But we're not going to recognize the generosity of God until we start fitting in and living within the limits. Because if we live with such abundance and taking more than our share, we're going to be like my nephew at Christmas time when he opened his presents and toy after toy after toy, and by the fifth or sixth or seventh toy, he was just kind of ripping them open and throwing them aside. He no longer saw it as something really nice and desirable, this creative deprivation that John mentioned, I think, a couple of days ago. I see that at Christmas time with kids, and we're like that. We have so much that we don't even appreciate what we have anymore. I think it's like fasting. Food never tastes better than after you've been fasting. We just kind of take it for granted. It's something great and good, and yeah, we expect it. But until we live with a little bit of creative deprivation or see where we fit in, I don't think we can fully appreciate what God's abundance is for us. Okay, so how can I begin to live more simply? Well, I came up with 7 points. 5 I'll discuss briefly. 2 I'm not going to mention or talk much about. I'll just mention them because I think we'll talk more about them Saturday. First of all, it seems to me that if we're going to start to live more simply, we have to de-accumulate. I have a friend who just started working at Bloomingdale's. Bloomingdale's, if you don't know about it, is the most ritzy department store in the whole world. There are 2 Bloomingdale's. One is in New York City, and they just opened a branch store in Falls Church, Virginia. Falls Church. And Anne went to apply for a job there. They don't pay much more than the minimum wage, which I never could understand. But she was going to work in the gourmet food department. And in order to do this, she had to learn the names and the consistency and learn to, by taste, 300 different kinds of cheeses, so that she would be able to intelligently discuss with the customer their need for cheese. Then she was told, you must be very gracious and courteous to the people with the gold charge plates. Now, in order to get a gold charge plate at Bloomingdale's, you must charge each year $10,000 worth of merchandise. Now, I don't know what Bloomingdale's has, because frankly, I've never shopped at Bloomingdale's. I know they had a 20 minutes on a segment on 60 Minutes one night of the New York Bloomingdale's, and you could buy a tenny runner and everything from a shoe to a medallion that you wore around your neck in blue, turquoise, and gold or something, or you could buy a huge bed that was in the shape of a tennis shoe that you tied up at night or something. I mean, I guess you can spend $10,000 at Bloomingdale's. And she said it isn't that that's just one or two people. There are many people that have gold charge plates at Bloomingdale's. John used to go to St. Anselm's Abbey, which is a Benedictine monastery in Washington, D.C. He would go there once a week and just study and read and meditate and so forth. And after a couple of years, I think he also got to be the chief counselor for many of the monks. But one thing he found out was that at Lent, every monk in the abbey was asked to make a list of the things that they had in their room. And they would list all their underwear and their shoes and their records and their books and their plants. And then they would take the list to Father Abbott, and Father Abbott would say, I think this is more than you need. This is enough of this. You don't need that. Let's get rid of this and this and this and this and this. There are people in this city that need these things more than you do. And they would take them away. It was called kind of a deaccumulation process before Lent.
Now that's... do that at supper for the village.
Right. Good Lenten discipline. Well, I'm not sure I want somebody going into my suitcase or in my closet and seeing how many of this that I have. I'd like to do that for myself. And we kind of started that in our family. You know, make a list of what you really need. Anything above and beyond that is superfluous. And anything you have that more than you need, you are literally stealing it for somebody else. I really believe that. We just heard of a man who does this quite literally. He makes a list of how many pair of underwear he has to have, how many shoes, one good suit, a couple sport coats, three shirts or whatever. And he lives with that amount of clothes, which fits very nicely into a small closet. If anyone gives him something else at Christmas or for a birthday, he thanks them. He is genuinely pleased to receive it, but he makes sure that he either gives that away to somebody or something like it. If it's a sweater and he's already had a sweater, he gives his other sweater away. Therefore, he keeps within his possession only those things that he feels he really needs to have. I don't know whether that appeals to you or not, but it's one way to deaccumulate. Secondly, I think we should kick the energy habit. We are energy addicts, and all of us pity addicts, you know, if they're alcoholic or if they're drug addicts or whatever they are, or if they can't stop smoking. We don't think of ourselves as addicts very often unless we have one of those blaring social sins. But we are energy addicts, at least I am, because I came across an energy addicts chart the other day that I'll share with you. The United States uses 3 times more energy per person than any other country in the world. Now, I'm talking about even first world countries. Are you all aware of the five worlds? I mean, I don't want to... First world are the developed industrialized nations. That's the United States, Canada, Western Europe, basically. The second world are the communist bloc nations. The third world are the developing countries. The fourth world, which is just a new category in United Nations language, are those countries that are not even developing. They make $100 per person a year or less. Those are the fourth world countries. Countries like Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, some of those countries. They now, it's a new one to me, and John mentioned it yesterday, Chad is a fifth world nation. There's just no hope for Chad. It's landlocked, it has no natural resources of its own, there is no industry. So economically speaking, the world is divided into 5 worlds. Of course, we named them so we're the first world. That's how that comes to be. But anyway, the United States uses 3 times more energy than even the countries in the rest of the first world, in the rest of the industrialized countries. We use 250,000 calories of energy. Now, I don't know exactly how they figured this out. I had the whole information and I didn't bring the book along. But if you take my word for it, it's just a relative thing anyway that I want to show you. 250,000 calories per day per person are consumed in the United States. Europe Western Europe, which is also first world, uses 70,000 calories per person per day. The third world people use 40,000 calories of energy a day, and the People's Republic of China is the lowest with 12,000 calories of energy per day. All right, if that doesn't mean much to you, if you have a black and white television, you will use 775 calories, energy calories an hour. If it's a colored television, that amount doubles. You use twice as much energy if you have a colored television as if you have a black and white. If you have an insulated home, it will use 30,000 calories a day of energy to heat it. If your house is not well insulated, that doubles. It's 60,000 calories of energy. If you use a washing machine, an electric washer, where you throw your clothes in and put the quarter in or whatever you do up here, you'll use 450 energy calories an hour. Then if you throw those in the dryer, you will use over 4,000 calories of energy calories an hour. So if you can hang them on a clothesline or put them over a brown rack or hang them above your bathtub or stretch lines in your house in the wintertime, you are saving an awful lot of energy because it takes 4,100 calories of energy to run electric dryer for an hour. If you have a 14 cubic foot refrigerator freezer, it will take 9,000 calories a day. If that same refrigerator freezer has an automatic defroster on it, you up it to 16,000 calories. So it's just, I really think there ought to be a law in this country that just as on food, what's in it, maybe our appliances should say how much energy these are taking. I mean, I'm really angry that the refrigerator we got, even though it was secondhand, has an automatic defrost on it. I had always lived with one that I had to defrost manually. It was no big deal. But now, oh, it seemed really like a nice idea. Here was this used refrigerator, and it even had an automatic defroster. And we saw our electric bill jump shortly after we got that, and I couldn't figure it out until I read this. And I really think that had a lot to do with it. Okay, so maybe knowing, well, I think everybody knows that a small compact car probably gets 100% more miles to the gallon than a big model, but the sales of small cars are going down in the United States, and they sold more Cadillacs and Lincolns last year than ever before. So we don't seem, even though 1974 wasn't far away, or whenever the energy crisis was at the gas tank, it didn't seem to last very long in our minds. Knowing that cotton and wool clothes take so much less energy to produce than nylons and dacrons. I was talking with a man the other day that said, believe me, my wife won't have anything in the house that isn't wash and wear. And I wanted to say, yeah, but do you realize the amount of petroleum that's being used to create this, and how much extra energy is used? It's really it's another thing in simplifying your life if you can maybe not only shop at Goodwill, but look for cotton labels again. We kind of got away from that, and then you think, well, then I have to get out the iron and iron it, so maybe it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. But remember that cotton and wool are much more in line with an economic distribution of the world's goods than using the kind of very elaborate wash and wear kind of materials that we have. Okay, deaccumulate, kick the energy habit. Number three I have is waste less. That seems very obvious. But did you realize that there are no antique waste paper baskets? Nobody has ever found in an antique store a waste paper basket. Waste is something very, very new. Did you realize that it's built-in waste when you fly on an airline? They always put in much more food than they know will be there. I don't know why. And they're not allowed to do anything with this food except throw it out. At McDonald's, everybody's favorite little fast food place, if hamburgers have been there more than 7 minutes, they are thrown out. If French fries are there more than 10 minutes without being purchased, no, it's the other way around. French fries, 7 minutes, hamburgers, 10 minutes, they're thrown out. If coffee sits in a pot for more than 30 minutes, it is thrown out. This isn't because McDonald's wants to waste a lot of food and throw stuff out, but simply because you and I as customers, if you do go in and buy hamburgers at McDonald's, we demand that we have a quick, hot hamburger and french fry meal, and we don't want to stand around and wait. I'm not blaming McDonald's, but I'm saying our lifestyle is such a hurry-up thing and such, you know, what we want it on demand, that we put this kind of demand on others. Are you aware that 20% of the food in the United States is either eaten by rats or rots before it ever gets to the supermarkets? 20% of everything we produce. It's a much higher percent in countries, in the developing countries, because they don't even have the proper kind of basic kinds of storage bins and things and refrigeration. And 10% of all the food purchased by American families goes out in the garbage or down the disposal. That's not coffee grounds and eggshells and banana peels. It's literally, especially produce, fish, chicken, ground beef that sits in the refrigerator and turns purple and then gets mold on it or something. But 10% of everything we purchase gets thrown in the garbage can. I think they did a survey, some university did it in Phoenix, went through all the garbage for a year in Phoenix and came to the conclusion that the people in Phoenix could have fed, I think, 44,000 people, extra people, from what they just threw out. Styrofoam cups. We have a friend who's in ecological concerns for the American Lutheran Church, and his biggest gripe is churches that use styrofoam cups at their coffee hour. It's foolish. We got around this in our church in Washington, D.C. by buying everyone, or having everyone that joined the church, buy a ceramic mug. You paid $1 for it, and then you put your name on it, and you decorated it, and you hung it up on a pegboard. One wall of the place where we worshipped was nothing but a pegboard of about 100 mugs. Now, granted, we only had 70 to 100 people in our congregation, but it was a lot of fun to do, and we had 10 or 12 cups that weren't painted for visitors that came, and we had a bowl of soapy water at the end of the coffee hour, and everybody washed their own cup and hung it up again. And when you left the church, it was a lot of fun because you didn't know whether to take your mug with you or pass it on to somebody else or smash it in the middle of the floor with the congregation standing around you. But we really had a lot of fun with those ceramic mugs. And I think being a little bit more creative or thinking a little bit more about these things, how many times have you been on a retreat where they use styrofoam mugs? You could have written your name on it, on the styrofoam cup on Friday night and used it through till Sunday afternoon, but no. Every time the coffee pot comes up or a meal comes up, you throw it away and you get another one. I just think we have to start being a lot more aware that plastic doesn't just disintegrate. You know, it's with us forever and ever. Amen. There is no way to get rid of that kind of thing. And yet, even though we know that, we aren't making many moves to do something about it. Okay, number four. Let's go with some inconveniences. Simple life is not necessarily a convenient life, and it's not necessarily easy. I don't know why we think we have to have everything so convenient. Certainly in view of what's going on in the world, it is immoral to think that I have to live in such a way that everything is convenient. And we do it every day. You know, it's more convenient to drive my car than to take the bus. And it's certainly more convenient to ride than to walk. And it is more convenient to throw my clothes in a dryer than hang them out on the line. My electric slaves, my electric hair dryer or toothbrush or disposal or trash compactor or whatever it is that I have is electric is very convenient, but is it moral? I guess I'd say no. It's more convenient to own something myself than to try to share it with somebody else. It's more convenient to own my own car than to share it with a neighbor, or to have my own subscription to Newsweek or Lutheran Standard or what, than to share it. Or it's my own record collection because I want the record when I want it instead of sharing it with several other people. All of these things, I think, we have to get away from the idea that convenient life is a very good way to live. Fifth, enriching our lives in ways that do not harm others or our environment. I think this is very much a part of simple life, to enrich our lives. And I just always think of Holden as an example when I talk about this. So I feel funny saying these things again, because I think we right now are living in the kind of atmosphere that I think in many, many respects is what I think of when I think of simple life. And these are the reasons that I think of it. Think that Holden has caught a glimpse of what a simple life is all about. First of all, we join with others who share our values, and I think that's very important. It's very hard to live a simple life alone, not only because you're kind of thought of as peculiar, but you need the support of a group of Christian people who share your values. And if you can't share it literally in some kind of community living, can you share it through writing or mailing or such as the Order of St. Martin or something like this? There are groups that feel the same way as many of us do, and I think we need the mutual support and communication with these other people. At least I cannot try to simplify my life alone. I really need not only my family to help me, but other people who are encouraging and understanding about it. And I think another thing about enriching our lives is that we have to learn to be more creative, and Holden certainly a place where you do that. We shouldn't always depend on others for what we have. It's kind of neat to know that you can do some of these things by yourself and that you don't always rely on others to supply your basic needs, whether this is food or clothes or entertainment or whatever it is. I think also that we share workload with others. This is very important in a simple life to me. You know, I add my gift to your gift, and together we can do things together. It's a lot more fun, it's a lot of fellowship, and it's certainly, I can't possibly learn to do all the things that I need to know. I can't do everything myself. I need other people, and I have to have you. And fourth, D under enriching our lives, whatever it is, to think of alternative ways of celebrating Christmases and birthdays, and I think you do that at Holden too. You know, how many times, especially with parents and grandparents, oh, it's their birthday or it's Christmas, what in the world can I give them? And it always has to be some kind of a material thing that we give them. And they probably would be the first to tell you, I don't need anything. I know as a parent now, and my kids say, Mom, what do you want for Christmas or what do you want for my birthday? I really can't think of anything I need or I want. You know, I used to say, I want you to be a good girl or whatever that Thornton Wilder play was, or be honest and thought, word, and deed, or whatever. But to think of, you know, plants, giving somebody a concert ticket, writing them a little note and saying, I'm going to take care of your kids for the next four nights if you want to go out, or the next four weekends. Thinking of different ways, and I know you do that at Holden because I've been here when you've celebrated that way, and I think, why do we have to be at Holden before we think of these things? Is it just that we're far away from the marketplace, or that we have more time here to be creative? I don't know what it is, but I think simple life really means that you have to enrich your lives in ways that don't harm others or manipulate other people or harm the environment. And again, I think we're all very environmentally conscious at Holden, and I commend you for it. I think it's a fine example of simplicity. The two that I just will mention but will not spend time on now, simple life also means changing the structures of society which cause injustice. And that means to me to get into the political arena and do a lot of fighting there. And the other thing is our eating habits. We can't live a simple life and continue to eat like most of us do. But we're going to dwell on that more fully Saturday. Okay, but why begin a new way of seeing? Why think that one of the things that make for peace is a changed lifestyle? And I have, I guess, three things that I'd like to share with you. I don't think any of us will work to affect larger changes in society if our lifestyle will be threatened by those changes or is inconsistent with those changes. Let me say it another way. I'm not going to go out and work for disarmament if I keep a gun in my house to frighten an intruder that might come in and try to steal my grandfather's clock or whatever. And I don't think I'm going to work for world hunger if I don't somehow or other start changing my own eating habits. So I think a lifestyle change has to be consistent with a larger change that you're looking for in society. I'm not sure I'm making that clear. Secondly, I think it's where you have the most power. Most of us feel so guilt-ridden or burdened with the complexities of global injustice. And, you know, it's the population explosion and the B-1 bomber and the Trident submarine and all of these problems that just weigh you down. You think there's absolutely nothing I can do about this. So I do nothing. I just become incapacitated. Well, I think you can start where you have the most power, and that is in your own lifestyle. Gandhi said, full attempt is victory. You know, even a small step is okay. And I think that's the next point I want to make, that small steps are okay. They are transitional kind of steps. I don't think it's going to be a change in our lifetime. But I think for the sake of our kids and our kids' kids and our great-grandchildren, that until we start making some basic changes, these are transitional steps, because it was a series of small lifestyle changes that got us into the mess we're in now. And I really think it can be a series of small lifestyle steps and changes that maybe take us back. And yes, there's going to be some social dislocation, and yes, there will be some people put out of work, but it seems to me that we can create some different kinds of employment and some things that help to better society instead of just building a lot more cars or something. Proverbs says, where there is no vision, the people perish. And even just a small vision that we might have, I think is really worthwhile.
Are you talking about the type of thing he talks about in small change? Small and beautiful, that's right.
Yeah. Have you read that?
Parts of it.
Yeah, he's got a whole chapter there.
It just strikes me, it seems to me almost the most encouraging thing I can think of that you just said was that we achieve this in a series of small steps. And the way to maybe get out of it is in a series of small steps. That really is significant.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really is that way. I think about when I was a teenager, there weren't things like in the stores, and people didn't have stereos in their mm-hmm. all over the place, and stacks and stacks of records and stuff. We just didn't live that way. As recently as that. But it is small steps. I think that's true.
Yeah, I think, Karin, those small steps, at no point did we think we were the problem because we were just one person or it was so small.
Sure.
And I think the small steps in the other direction, at no point will we think we're the solution because it's only one.
Yeah.
But just as it was the accumulation before, so an accumulation of lifestyle changes is a significant thing. Yeah.
You're falling right into my final paragraph.
Good.
Sir Hubert Butterfield, whoever he is, some historian, I read a quote by him the other day. He said, it's every man, capital letter E, every man, not just the upper class, but every man who wants to live just a little bit better than his father, or increase his sales just a little bit, or who really dreads any kind of decline in his standard of living, that puts tremendous pressures on the government, and I would add, puts tremendous pressures on the world. And Lenin, atheist that he was, said, boy, if I had 12 St. Francis's of Assisi, I could revolutionize the world. You know, we could start de-accumulating if we had just 12 St. Francis's who had the vision and the love of Lady Poverty. Then he went on to say, let's see if I can find it. Could not a million St. Francis's promote a revolution of lowered expectations at the material level and reveal to us the secret of better kinds of wealth? You know, I think that says the same thing. If it's every single person that got us into the mess we're in, then every single person can start to take what looks like a step backwards, but I really don't think it is. I think it's a step forward. And that little audacious madman, St. Francis, had the audacity to say, you know, it's in giving that we receive, and it's in dying that we are born. And I think we have to hear that again. I guess what I would say as far as simple life is concerned is that when we go on a vacation, what are the things you do? You know, you generally take a trip to be close to nature, and you go with your family and you try to get in closer touch with the people you love, and you dress very casually and comfortably, and you eat very simply because you want to have more time to be creative and enjoy nature. And we call that, you know, a vacation. And I guess I call that simple life. So I think what we all ought to do is just be on one continual vacation. Comments. Little speeches, as John says.
Yesterday when John was talking about the dilemma of some people that you knew in having to explain to their kids why they probably won't be as live with as many material comfort as they are right now. I think that's a problem that exists even for kids of my generation with their parents. Well, my parents are of the generation that slaved and sacrificed so that we could have the things they didn't. And now that might not be possible. And that's, you know, that presents the need for helping them deal with that. That's hard for my father to face, that I won't have a house that's better than he does, than he has. That I won't drive a fancy car because those are the things he worked for. And now they face the dilemma, and you know I face the dilemma in dealing with my parents as well.
It works both ways like that, even with the thing you were talking about with Christmas times and birthdays. For some reason, I've known that, well, you said for a long time, I've known that it's just as senseless to receive all kinds of gifts when I don't need anything. And there have been times when I've tried to communicate that to my parents, or I've heard one of my brothers trying to communicate that to either parents or grandparents, or you know, even friends of mine are in this situation too. And that's almost, I don't know if it's more difficult or not, but it's a real touchy area when, you know, when you're not the person in control of the situation. Really.
It looks so much like ingratitude.
Because they think you're rejecting them, and that's hard to deal with.
And it makes me think that somehow the change is actually going to be a lot easier for the children to grow up with if their parents are able to help them grow up with it. Because it's almost a more natural thing for children to want, you know, to understand a sense of balance and sharing. You know, although that's not always true in their everyday play. But, you know, when, like, suggesting to children the idea of bringing in a toy to a charity, well, most children who are able to do that are really happy to. And so I think it's really true what Bev was saying, that it's harder almost for the people who've had it, who've seen things a different way.
But there are still, a poll I read said that, some Harris poll not too long ago, that youth in college and high school age, upper middle class youth, this was, still thought of that they were entitled to and were working to make sure that they had as much, if not more, as their upper class parents. I mean, I wish it was more widespread. And I know what you're saying, and
I
wish everybody felt that way.
Something that I've never understood kind of what you just said there, because the majority of my life when I was growing up was extremely simple, not by choice on my parents' side, but because of the real lack of money. And within the last couple of years, 4 or 5 years, there's been a lot of money. My family has been a lot more complex. But still, I'm having trouble understanding why so many of my friends are starting out a marriage with a brand new home and brand new furniture. and great indebtedness. And that, to me, seems a complexity right there. I just have trouble understanding that.
Mm-hmm. Elise?
Seems like another possibility of looking at the birthday, Christmas, and celebration. And that's related, but maybe it's just out of my biography, like that means just some other people that where we weren't saturated with good very often. I mean, it was the Easter Christmas for us. that kind of a thing. And I think that our children have the opportunity or the having parents that could provide a lot more than my parents could provide for us, but that the moments of celebration and the joy of giving gifts is a very real one that I carry, and I think all my brothers and sisters do, and I wouldn't give that notion into any particular form. If we have, then the gift takes a material kind of a form or shape, if that's what is for the person. There's a sense of paying attention to the person you're giving a gift to, not what you're doing with, you know, see, you should love this because I made it. Maybe it's, you know, if my children make it, I don't but I mean, I shouldn't make my sisters
suffer.
Crochet dishcloths if my grandmother's already made $600. That kind of thing, just because I made it, it should be an endearing sign. And I guess that isn't to make shoulds increase in that line either, but it was just something I thought about. If you live at a certain level, then in order to make a celebration in anything, the material flourish is so much greater again. You have to get that horsehair rocking horse for the kids. You can't, you know, an old wooden rocking horse doesn't do.
I really feel if there is a need on somebody's part, that getting them that thing that they need or desire is certainly legitimate.
It's almost a time to allow some desires and up maybe even beyond need. It seems to me. I mean, but that's part of giving. It isn't something, there are things that I can appreciate as gifts. When you mentioned that about money, it was so strange because I had just re-received a really generous gift just as we were going out to Seattle a couple weeks ago. And I was thinking about it, the two gifts. Yeah, little fun to do something with. Both givers, I said, oh no, oh don't, oh we don't need that. Oh. And it was really, like you related, a shortcoming in the sense of my own humanity, not wanting to have to accept something. And not wanting to have to accept something in a pleasurable sense. If I had really been destitute, maybe I would say, no, I don't know. I took it, and we were thinking about what to do with it, and I thought, we've been talking all our lives about, well, everything we have is yours, God. This we are just giving you thine own back on Sunday. And if that made as clear a mark on me, even in small instances, my life as a gift from a friend makes a mark on how I use money. How can I use that? That's really particular money. That was given out of this person's life, you know. And here we're talking about our whole life belongs to God and everything in them. And I think it's a lot of pious mouthing, you know. We ought to be the best. Christians should be so good at receiving. We shouldn't think twice. And it's still a difficult thing, you know.
There's a graciousness to it that most of us haven't learned, I think.
Tournier talks about the hardest gift to receive is the one that's absolutely free and undeserved. You know, you're speaking of grace, but you can apply that to material things too. It's just an absolutely free and undeserved gift is just so terribly hard to receive.
To take a different tack here.
If it's an economic question, I'm going to die.
No, I'm not a banker. I was thinking of the term standard of living that gets batted around so much, and you often hear about the United States or first world living, you know, high standard of living, and that in the use of that term, whenever that came up, it would be a really good place to, with yourself, begin a different way of understanding and seeing. By realizing that know, if standard of living is maybe not in terms of materialism, but in terms of simplicity, then it could be really true that proceeding from a regular old refrigerator to a defrosting refrigerator could be a decrease in your standard of living. Seriously.
Yeah.
And to, you know, apply that across the board, and then in terms of thinking, maximizing your standard of living, you can be doing that even as you're shedding off material.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
very good.
Just the word standard itself implies value. Mm-hmm.
I had to laugh at that because I have a friend who lives right in the middle of the city in Omaha, and he doesn't have any electricity. He won't pay the bill or won't have it because he doesn't think that he needs it. And I've never run into anybody like that before in the city. And no, you know, he eats whatever's given to him or whatever's fresh somewhere that doesn't need to be refrigerated or anything like that. But I don't know anybody inside a city other than him that doesn't have electricity by choice. By choice. that was the key word there.
I think it was Deb that told me this about the Courtney family.
Yeah, they won't have electricity.
They refused to have electricity put into their home because they didn't agree with the power that their hydro plant was connected to. But Deb told me, I guess it was Ben Nielsen told her that they have a little generator that's run on gasoline or something. And the one thing that they fire up the generator for is when haircutting time comes.
Courtney gets on the electric clipper and they fire up the generator. Everybody in the family gets a haircut.
And you know, I really think that's something kind of that they, this is just my own, idea, but they have about five or six boys and one little girl. One of their boys was drowned about 10 years ago. And they are always, I mean, their hair is cut and it's short. Not a hiney, but just really well groomed, you know. They are definitely not what your nowadays typical wilderness family looks like. And that just may be, you know, sort of a ritual they go through just to prove their individuality. That they're not going to, they don't run around with real long, shaggy hair.
I also think that it's really, that it represents a real responsibility on their part. They, as I see it, they think that they have a certain amount of energy that they can use. And they establish their priorities, and cutting hair with an electric shears was a priority, and that's what they use it for. I think that's really responsible.
Mm-hmm. There was a town that passed fall somewhere in the Midwest, about 250 or 300 people, that when phone rates went up as a protest, they decided for 1 week to discontinue their phones. So they all did, and they only had one phone at the gas station, one phone at the general store.
Yeah.
And after the week, they decided to make it a permanent thing because they loved it so much.
Yeah.
developed a feeling of community that had never been there before and everything.
Yeah, this gets back to the needs and giving and that kind of stuff. I think when you're talking about that, you know, accepting our needs and being able to give and everything, I think the most important thing you said for me was the whole concept of sharing, which is what we talk a lot about. But it seems that in order to live this simple lifestyle, that you can, like you said, continually have to live with a sharing feeling, not a giving feeling or a taking feeling. Because if you've got it to give, it's really easy to assess somebody else's needs on the basis of what you have to give. And my grandmother does that to her grandchildren all the time. She knows her own needs and will take nothing, you know. But my word, you go to eat, you know, I go over for lunch and she just heaps food on the plate and it, more than I can eat, and it hurts if I don't take it. So she assesses what she can give according to what she thinks my needs should be.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, and also to make me feel good and her feel good. And I just think about that really strongly because that's so easy to do. You know, but if you think in terms of sharing, it becomes, I can't even articulate what I'm thinking on that yet, but it comes in a completely different light than even giving and receiving. Even sharing in terms of Christmas gifts.
Just that one example which you brought.
I'll give you a record, you can let me listen to it. Oh.
That reminds me of, well, just the whole standard we have relating to food. Maybe you're going to get into this more Saturday, but just we think in terms of food. And it's just, that's so strange. We fought that all year long. We just had to just fight it. We were just forced, you know, food down our throats, you know. And it was people's way of showing their love and their gratitude, and that's so strange, you know.
I think, well, like what Nancy just said, I have a great-grandmother that is very close to me, and it's the same way. She, well, you know, she's got a huge garden for it. She still lives in her own home. She's got a big garden and a fruit garden and vegetable garden and everything. She makes a lot of her own stuff, and whenever I go over there, which, you know, whenever I'm home is like twice a week or so, just spend the day with her. She said, well, she goes, your stomach's empty every 2 hours, Chucky. Every 2 hours you have to eat a full meal. And she'll make platters and platters of food. And what I did for Christmas, I got like some flour and stuff and gave her that as a Christmas present, a box of food. And she wouldn't touch it. She would not touch it at all except to make it for food for me to eat. And, but, you know, it's really beautiful in a way. It's not, it's really sort of what she lives for in a way, just to feed other people. So.
Did we tell you about David Alexander Belford? Well, no, that would have been, I think we did last time we were at Holden, so some of you heard this again. He was a guy that just came to our door one time in Washington, D.C., and he talked like this whenever he said anything. And he said that he had been told that this was a place where he could get some food to eat, so we brought him in. And he appeared, every month or so he would come. He had only the clothes that he had on his back. He was in his late 20s. All he carried around with him was a diary that he wrote in every single day, and his diary must have been 10 or 12 volumes, and it was carried in big suitcases. And one time he said, I like to eat at your house. It makes Christians feel good to be able to feed us that don't have any food to eat. That's why I do it. Makes you feel good. And same way when, you know, it's good to take some of John's socks or underwear because he has more than he needs and it makes him feel good, you know, to be able to share this with But I don't know why I couldn't rejoice with his way of thinking. The same way I got very upset, I think I told somebody this the other day, a couple that came to our first parish to talk to us. They had worked with Dave Wilkerson in New York, I think I was telling Ron about. And they lived what is called a quote-unquote faith life, that other people would take care of them and provide for them. So when she came to our house and had no diaper bag for her baby or diapers, well, naturally, I said, take our diaper bag, because my kids were older, or I had two or something, and I gave her a half a dozen diapers, and she said, the Lord always provides. And, you know, and when John took the guy out to lunch, he said, I've never yet picked up a check. I have a real difficult time with this kind of logic or something.
Wouldn't you almost have a tendency to look upon that as a type of leeching?
Well, but you know, they're very right. God did provide David Belford with a meal and every time he came and
know,
her with a diaper bag.
There's a day when they must provide for others.
Well, I assume they felt that just the giving of themselves and their experience and their work was what they gave. I don't know. I mean, I have a very hard time, this is a confession, putting charitable construction on that kind of...
Yeah, because God provides the Rockefellers meals every day, too. I mean, you can explain the meal if God provided it in a lot of different ways. I think, and I don't like the sense of being manipulated.
And yet, in the Gospels, Jesus sent out 72 people, and he said, don't take any money with
right.
you. He said, don't take even an extra pair of socks. Just go and stay in the house. And if they, you know. So how do you balance these things?
Well, that's how I...
Well,
enjoyed David Alexander Belford. I tried to think of him as one of Jesus' disciples that was obviously coming to my door. You know. But, then there were FBI agents in our backyard for several days watching our house. And when John finally went up and said, "You guys look like cops. What are you doing?" They said, "Well, we have the address of a David Alexander Belford, and it's this address, and he's threatened the life of the President of the United States. We're looking for him." And he said, when he came back, he said, "Mr. Schramm, I did not threaten the life of the President of the United States. All I said was..."
Yeah, that was really pathetic and touching. He said, "I wrote him a letter. Nixon said something in the paper about you cannot travel without being fearful for your life or something. He was talking about crime. And David wrote him a letter and said, "Mr. President, you said you're afraid to travel. I have traveled," and he named, "I have traveled through the counties of 36 of our states. I have never carried a gun. I have been in no danger. You do not have to be afraid, Mr. President." And then he looked at me and with utter sanity said, "That's a threatening letter." And he was right. He was just trying to say, you don't have to be scared. And so the FBI came after him. But he worked that one all right. He said, when the FBI wanted to see him, he said, "I'll meet you at Linda's cafeteria near DuPont Circle." And he said, and he bought my coffee.
He got a ride with his thing was going through the whole United States into every county, visiting the county courthouse and getting a map of that county and storing them in our basement because he wanted to start a county map museum in Washington so that anyone came to visit D.C. could go to this map museum and look up their county. I said, "David, why would you come to D.C. and want to go look up your county map? Oh, it would be very helpful, you know." And so,
well, I guess I could see how he would pay for his own coffee to the
payment value.
Oh, well, I guess my point is, I just think, you know, what if everybody in the world was like this? You know, it's obvious that we can't all be that way. I don't know what that is.
raising that question, do you, in the course of your efforts at finding alternative lifestyles and such, does that question or category arise often of, is this that we're doing something that everybody else could do? Is that a way of deciding, of making decisions about what is or is not a responsible way of living? Does that make sense? It philosophically goes back to...
expressing my thought, that I didn't vocalize it, but I go right along your line, which was, if you could have things as you express them right now, everybody in the world automatically lives a simple life, what would happen tomorrow morning?
Yeah, but see, that was the point of the step-by-step. It's not a matter of everything.
Yeah, I can understand that, but if you wanted to get there from here, you have to realize...
Well, we came here from there.
Where? I was born in the time before there was a television or a radio or any of that stuff. We lived a very simple life. The plumbing was done outdoors.
Yeah.
Well,
so I know all about how you live as an individual. I'm saying if we could get back, because we know what the resources are of this world. We were only using a part of it. You can go back before fire, or you can go back after fire as a human being. But somewhere along the line, you have to say, what is the parameter of where you're going to go with these little steps? It's nice to talk about it, but we all like to have a president like Mr. Carter because he thinks of the common man. So does Mr. Meany. They all want to increase the allocation to their own kind. Probably half of them are Christians, or a fourth or three fourths, I don't know. I haven't got the figures. But what is going to happen is that we want somebody, and that somebody is the, we are a microcosm of the people in Washington who are now approving handing money to those people who are now living a simple life because they can't get quite as much as I have, you have.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, what we have to do if we're really going to take a step that means something is to influence the type of government we want, because any form of Christianity from Jesus' time on down is just full of politics, unless there is a program for, we can't talk in a room like this and do other things in all of our political subdivisions and units which make what we want to do impossible.
But I think...
So I don't see how you get there. You can pat yourself on the back, and I can pat myself on the back, and I do many times, because I give things, and I think, gee, what a good guy you're getting to be, you know? But all I'm doing is breaking my own arm. Because if we send food to the Indians over there, as soon as they get strength enough so that they can reproduce, they just make more Indians, which take more food. So they're just gradually trying to get up so they can walk. As we did when we start scratching the soil over here. Because my mother came to Dakota in a covered wagon and they started to scratch on the terra firma to see if they could do something about getting a living out of the soil. And as soon as the Arab strikes oil, he gets out of his tent and he holds a club over us, so our energy cost goes up. So he just boggled my mind. But suggesting that we have a simpler life, but they say, oh, what are you going to do in the world? What are you going to do with education?
Well, we don't have to give up the education.
I think it's not a going back, but a moving in a new direction. You know, we're not going to go back and live in tents on the plain.
Why not? You aren't?
Because we have, a lot of resources now that we didn't have before. And they can be used, but they have to be used in a different direction.
Well, now we're just talking about one facet of it. We're talking about energy. That we're going to use resources. Resources are a form of energy.
No, I don't think. I think she's expressing a very clear thought there. It's, you know, it's not a question of doing away with. We won't ever get rid of cars. We won't ever get rid of appliances. It's just a matter of, do we continue runaway consumerism? Do we continue the philosophy of planned obsolescence?
Saying,
you know, do we? Omar,
just
a minute. Let me talk. Do we continue the whole philosophy of producing and consuming as much as we cotton pick and can?
All right.
Or do we adopt a new philosophy or change our way of looking at it, where we realize that we are part of a global community and we must
all
cut
right.
back?
Just wait a minute. Don't generalize. If you produce as much as you can, what you produce is important. Not necessarily the automobile, but that's how you're going to feed the maximum number of mouths that are hungry.
Okay,
where?
I just read an article in Scientific American that said that, you know, our agricultural, we can advance more, we can produce more on the land that we have, blah blah blah, you know, you can extend it so we can feed this many people. But the methods to produce more, so we're gonna feed more people in India, but the methods to do that are gonna contribute to the complexity of society, and it we have to just take the whole thing in a different direction. You know, sure, by simplifying my lifestyle, I'm gonna starve some auto worker, but hopefully by simplifying my lifestyle, I'll help mankind 100 years from now.
Well, it took us 200 years to get here. It's going to take longer than that.
Right.
Well,
okay.
Well, they started someplace.
It's really dangerous to start loving mankind, though, and disregarding man.
Yeah.
I've heard so much of the not union rhetoric like that.
I can see each.
Was really, and I think that what if you're raising a question that I was thinking about yesterday, part of the why are we doing? Is it because it's efficient? Is it because it's utilitarian? But why are we changing? And the trouble seems to me partly to be that we have to use, you know, a lot of reasons, reasons from a lot of different banks. I mean, one thing is this bank account. The other thing says that we never put anything in that bank account in the first place. We don't know how much is in the bank account. We're creatures, we're not creators. We try to act like creators and we screw up people right now and we screw them up in 100 years. But that whole sense of there, what's in mind here? Is it to make me feel better? Is it because I have no choice? Am I following a directive? Have I said yes to something that was given as a choice? Is it something to encourage other people? In what sense, like what you talk about, that other, that people have to look at their own lives and see change in their own ways to a great extent. As soon as all of a sudden we point at whether or not you're wearing jeans or not as being the criterion, that's what, that's the kind of thing that makes me jump, because I feel like what kind of, that's like value. Jeans now would be the value, and is the point to get these four jeans when we wear, you know, why have jeans? Why not wear animals again? Well, the animals are extinct. Well, why not all move to the tropics? Well, because there's a food crisis. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. And yet at the same sense, you can see how carrying it beyond our givens might lead down some of those paths, at least to consider. Are we all equal? Are we all equal in sharing? In what sense are we equal? In what sense do we do things because we fear suffering?
I think too that if we're not observant of the simplicity or the simpleness and don't watch how complex things can get, we won't see the abusiveness in anything that we can, you know, how we can abuse something or how we can abuse an individual or maybe even be abused ourselves or abuse ourselves. And that goes along with your saying that we're energy addicts as we are physical and psychologically dependent on a lot of things.
I guess I really don't feel that the economic system that we have now is a moral kind of system, because it's not supply and demand. It's much artificially created demand, like the Defense Department. So I guess I don't feel badly about thinking that the economic system has to change. In fact, I really believe that the third and fourth worlds pretty soon are just going to stand up and say, you know, we're sick of being stood on, and they're going to change it. And I think John mentioned the other day that maybe this is how God works in history to change us. And I feel like if we don't try to simplify our lives and learn to live with less, who is going to be left in this world to help us all understand when the crash comes, you know, how to live? If our values aren't other than technology and more and bigger and better, who is there going to be to help the other? Maybe that's going to be the role of the Christian Church, to help other people learn how to live when what we now think of as our security is taken away from us. And maybe you're not as pessimistic as I about, you know, what's going to happen in the next 10 or 20 years. I just, like in Namibia, I can't imagine living in that situation and how that will be a nonviolent revolution or independence getting, I don't know, and maybe it will be violent. But, you know, we reach out like some octopus, as Schumacher says, and small is beautiful, because we put such demand on industry for our growth that we go out into all these other countries and we take what isn't ours and we use 40% of everything in the world for our lifestyle.